May be seated. Good morning again. After a short recess, the court is back in session. We have two more oral arguments. The next case, the fourth case of the day, is case number A22-777, Stacy Dembski and others versus U.S. Bank. Counsel, I assume, are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal, 5 minutes. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Dan Hall, here on behalf of Stacy Dembski, Lou Dembski, and Michael Dembski. And I'll often refer to them either as the Dembskis or the Dembski beneficiaries. In this case, U.S. Bank had control of 90% of the shares of a business that U.S. Bank determined was worth $33 million. In just 3.5 years, U.S. Bank caused the value of that business to plummet to just $100,000. This appeal concerns whether the beneficial owners of a Minnesota corporation, such as the Dembski beneficiaries, are entitled to any protection from those in control of the corporation, like U.S. Bank. The district court erred because it found that the beneficial owners cannot commence actions under Chapter 302A, Section 751, seeking equitable relief, and also erred by dismissing the Dembski beneficiaries' claim for breach of fiduciary duty. This court should now reverse. I want to start with the 302A 751 claim. Section 751 confers broad equitable authority to the courts in order to protect minority shareholders from conduct by those in control of the corporation. It is undisputed that the beneficial owners of a corporation can bring a motion under Section 751 seeking a buyout. The issue for this court is whether the beneficial owners can commence the action in the first instance. This court has already decided that issue. In Zinanko versus Vukelich, a 1991 decision, this court looked at a situation in which an incorporator had sued to bring a Section 751 buyout claim against his co-incorporator. The two of them owned a newspaper.
Do you have, counsel, that's a non-presidentialist decision and one that I think even if we looked at it for persuasive values, since it was an incorporator, might be a little different, but do you have any presidential cases you want to cite to us for that proposition?
So there's a couple of precedential cases that deal with the same or closely related issues. In 1990, in the Warthan versus Midwest Consolidated Insurance case, that's a 1990 decision, it predates the decision in Zinanko, the court addressed a situation where there was a combination of two insurance agencies. No shares of stock had yet been issued as of the time that a claim was brought under Section 751 to involuntarily dissolve the corporation. In that case, this court affirmed the decision to dissolve the corporation. That was brought by individuals who had control of the corporation, like beneficial owners here, but in a situation where there were no shares, and therefore there was no shareholder to invoke Section 1 of Section 751. And U.S. Bank in this case is saying, if you don't have a shareholder to bring the claim under Section 1, or if a shareholder does not commence the claim under Section 1, then you're out of luck. Then the
beneficial... Or you're in probate court, right?
Well, not necessarily. In this case, you have claims against U.S. Bank as trustee that are pending in a trust proceeding. But it would not be that case in every case. The rule that U.S. Bank is seeking to apply here would be that if individuals place their interest into a trust, then they would not be able to bring claims against the majority shareholders of the company. And that's a fairly common estate planning tool, to put shares of a business into a revocable trust while someone is alive, or to transfer them into an irrevocable trust when someone dies. Under a rule in which beneficial owners are left with no remedy, anyone who transfers their shares of a corporation into a trust during their life gives up their right to protection under Minnesota's shareholder laws. And it also creates a recipe for malfeasance by those in control, other shareholders or others in charge of a company, whenever someone passes away, because the beneficial owners can't then bring it.
Hall, maybe the legislature should have done something differently, but when I look at 302A.751, you know, looking at the buyout motion, and it talks about inaction under subdivision 1, clause B, we look at that, and it says inaction by a shareholder. You know, and your clients aren't shareholders. I just don't see how we get around that.
There's two issues that I would say in response to that. First, the only courts that I'm aware of that have directly considered whether a beneficial owner can bring a claim under Section 302A, 751, are this court in the unpublished Zinanco case and Judge Bernhardsen in the Lund decision. In both cases, the courts looked at what the purpose of Section 751 was and said it would be an absurd result, that's the language from Zinanco, if this meant that a beneficial owner could not commence the action in the first instance. Judge Bernhardsen said it would be an exceedingly narrow reading of the statute, inconsistent with its broad, equitable nature, and with the jurisprudence that has developed around Section 751. From the Pedro decisions back in the early 1990s through the Lund decision, including the published decision from this court has recognized the broad, flexible nature of that remedy.
But that, in that case, Ms. Lund was a minority shareholder, obviously, right?
That's not accurate under U.S. Bank's reading. If you look at the decision of this court, all of her interests in the Lund decision were held in trust. So she was not separately a shareholder. The district court found that she was a shareholder because she acted as both a trustee and a beneficiary. But in terms of her ownership, all of the ownership was as a beneficial owner. And importantly here, U.S. Bank is saying a trustee is not a shareholder either. So the Lund case is directly on point in that regard because Ms. Lund owned her interests in trust there. The other key piece of this here is in the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a decision on this just last week in the Else versus Auto Owners Insurance case. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at when there has been a judicial interpretation of a statute that has stood for a long period of time, that becomes a part of the statute itself. There is particular force to the concept of stare decisis, the idea that something has already been decided, when the legislature always has the ability to go back and change the statute to clarify it if the legislature had intended to.
But you just told us that the only cases on this particular point are a non-presidential case and a district court decision, correct?
Well, that directly address the issue.
Right, and that's what stare decisis, that would be what we would look for, right?
The related issue of whether someone other than a shareholder can bring an action under Section 751 is the Warthan case. That's a published decision from this court. It predates the Zinanco decision by 1 year. And so that's a published decision saying someone other than a shareholder can commence the action for involuntary dissolution under Section 1 of Chapter 751. And then we have multiple decisions following that have continued to say that others other than a technical shareholder under the specific definition relied on by U.S. Bank can bring this action. It happened in the Zinanco decision and happened again in the Lund decision, which this court affirmed. In that case, the defendants didn't raise the issue on appeal, so it didn't get directly addressed by this court, but the buyout award for someone who was a beneficial owner of shares and brought an action under Chapter 302A, Section 751, was upheld.
Mr. Hall, I want to make sure I understand your claim in count one based on the common law.
Sure.
I mean, based on the way you've pleaded it, it looks like you're seeking to prove a breach of U.S. Bank's fiduciary duty as a shareholder, as a co-shareholder with your clients, as a shareholder, but not as a trustee of a trust.
That's correct.
And not as the administrator, personal representative of an estate.
There are separate claims for U.S. Bank in its other roles as a trustee or as a special administrator. In these fiduciary duty cases, we spend a lot of time focused on what hat anyone is wearing at any particular point in time. And very often, a party wears multiple hats. They can be a director, they can be an officer, they can be an employee, they can be a shareholder, they can be a trustee or special administrator. In this case, U.S. Bank had at least three hats that we're focused on. They had the trustee hat, the special administrator hat. Those are addressed in separate
procedures. In this case? Yeah, not in this case. And it seems to me in this case you've pleaded it narrowly to focus solely on their status as a shareholder.
That's correct. And the cases were blocked before a single judge in the district court, so for convenience of discovery, and there was no decision about trial because this was obviously decided at a pleading stage. But yes, U.S. Bank, we pled U.S. Bank was the controlling shareholder of RTI. And U.S. Bank took a number of actions as a shareholder.
My follow-up question is, did the district judge analyze the motion to dismiss with respect to count one?
The district court found that U.S. Bank, it was undisputed that U.S. Bank was not a shareholder and dismissed the breach of fiduciary duty claim.
Well, I think I understand the district court's reasoning under count two, the statutory claim. I mean, because of the definition of shareholder in 302A. I'm unclear about the district court's reason for dismissing count one.
It's not clear to me that the district court looked in detail at what the pleadings actually say, because the district court said it's undisputed that U.S. Bank is not a shareholder. That was the finding that was there. The actual complaint includes numerous descriptions of actions that U.S. Bank took as a shareholder.
Can I stop you again? Did the district court rule that U.S. Bank is not a shareholder for purposes of the 751 claim or for all purposes? And I truly don't know. I'm asking. It's an earnest question.
I believe the district court ruled that U.S. Bank was not a shareholder for the purpose of the fiduciary duty claim.
Well, wait a minute. Count one.
Count one, correct.
Or both, in other words, then.
I don't think it necessarily addressed it whether it mattered for U.S. Bank to be a shareholder.
Yeah, okay.
Because U.S. Bank was indisputably in control, and Section 751 speaks to control.
I think you're right, that whether they were a shareholder under the statute, it was the question is whether the Dempseys were shareholders.
Correct.
Okay, so returning to my question, I'm sorry. So did the district court dismiss count one, the common law claim, did it base that on the premise that U.S. Bank is not a shareholder?
It made a finding that U.S. Bank was not a shareholder, and then it dismissed the claim. So I would say, yes, it did, and I would say that was mistaken.
Okay, and why is that error? What's your authority for saying that's error?
Well, it's a basic pleading standard question. The question is, what was pleaded in the complaint? And the complaint went through, in great detail, how U.S. Bank was the controlling shareholder of RTI. U.S. Bank took actions as a shareholder. It called shareholder meetings. It voted at the shareholder meetings to appoint a board of directors for RTI. It then, from that point forward, continued to act at combined shareholder and director meetings. And these are facts that are pleaded specifically in paragraphs 31 to approximately 36 or 37 of the complaint itself. The district court ignored those rulings and said it's undisputed that U.S. Bank is not a shareholder. That goes far beyond what was in the complaint. On appeal.
Well, can I just stop you there? You said the district court found. Was that a finding of fact or a conclusion? I thought that was a conclusion kind of based upon the statutory definition, based upon the facts that were pled.
Well,
because I think it makes a difference for our review.
I think on this record, the review is de novo and looks at what the allegations pleaded in the complaint are and what the fair inferences from them are. Here, the allegations pleaded in the complaint were that U.S. Bank was a shareholder. On appeal, U.S. Bank is trying to argue that the Dembski beneficiaries were required to plead specific facts that, in addition to just saying that U.S. Bank was a shareholder, plead the technical requirements of the definition under 302A011, which is the definition section of the statute. That's substituting technical pleading for what we have in Minnesota, which is notice pleading. Was there fair notice to U.S. Bank that there was a claim asserted against it as a shareholder when the complaint set forth in great detail the actions that U.S. Bank took as a shareholder, the fact that it was being sued in its capacity as the controlling shareholder of RTI, and all of the background information that went into that? I would submit that U.S. Bank did have fair notice of that. Once you get past the issue of whether U.S. Bank is a shareholder, you get to the issue of to whom did U.S. Bank owe fiduciary duties. And on this piece, there are several cases that we cite, but I would direct the court's attention to the Anderson versus Anderson case, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, the FS Photo case, which is an Eastern District of Virginia decision relied heavily on by U.S. Bank, both at the district court and on appeal, and to the district court decision in the Lund case. In all of those, the beneficial owners were recognized as being owed fiduciary duties. And here, we represent the beneficial owners. They were owed fiduciary duties, and U.S. Bank breached them. The claim should not have been dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Denise Ronnie. I'm from Robbins Kaplan. I have with me my partner, Tim Billion, and we represent U.S. Bank. May it please the court. Sincerely, this is a square peg in a round hole, and I think the questions that the panel has been asking reveals that.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Sincerely, I was saying that this case is a square peg in a round hole. And I want to dispense with a few of the boogeymen that have been raised. First, this concern, there's no relief for somebody like this, the Dembski beneficiaries. There are two pending actions in the proper capacities. U.S. Bank was the trustee and the special administrator and is not running away from the fact that they owe fiduciary duties in those capacities. Those actions are pending, they're proceeding. We're defending them vigorously, obviously. But that's the proper terrain for this suit to continue on. The district court, and the other point I wanted to make is the scare point that my colleague made, indicating that if this is going to create a situation where if somebody puts their interest in trust, then they have no remedy. That's not the case. There's a definition of shareholder that would simply allow them to title and put on the books and records of a company that the trust owned the shares. And if that was done properly, then obviously they could follow the statute, and that's not an issue. So in the simplest terms, the district court got it right. The district court did a very...
Can I go back to that? Are you saying there's a difference? I mean, there's a meaningful difference between whether the shares are owned by the trustee or owned by the trust itself?
Yeah, so, you know, there's been some focus on the Lund decision, for example, and I'll address a few things by talking about that. That's a very different situation where you actually have somebody's interest held in trust. I don't know the circumstances. I don't know if it was then put on the books and records. What I do know is that Judge Bernhardson found and explicitly noted in her decision that Kim Lund fell in the definition of both beneficial owner and shareholder. So for some reason, despite the fact that these were in trust, there was a finding that she was a shareholder. It's not the case here. And we're dealing with a trust that's an administrative trust. John Dembski owned 90% of RTI.
Well, so my question was just simply that if the corporate records reflect that a trustee owns shares and the trustee does so pursuant to a trust agreement and has And then on the other hand, if the corporate records reflect that shares are owned by the trust as, I guess, an entity or a thing, is there a meaningful difference there about, it seems to me in either event, the trustee has title to the shares, and then there are beneficiaries who have a beneficial interest.
So the
does it really matter how it's titled or how it's stated in the corporate records?
Yeah, I think it matters significantly, and the legislature gave us all the guidance. I mean, the legislature has a clear definition of shareholder and what you have to do to achieve that. It has a clear definition of beneficial owner and what you do to achieve that. It also has a clear definition under subdivision 16 of legal representative, which is what U.S. Bank's capacity was. A legal representative means a person empowered to act for another.
And these definitions in 302A, do they apply to both count and one and count two in this case?
Yeah, I think for purposes, so the breach of fiduciary, so I think the judge's reasoning and analysis on the 751 claims are clear. You can look at the statute. They're not, you know, the Dembskis are not shareholders.
I think I understand.
Yeah. Yep. As to a breach of fiduciary claim.
Common law.
You have to, I mean, I think one of the things in counsel's brief that's correct is it is typically and often a factual finding. But there are no facts here that get you to it. Now, is U.S. Bank a fiduciary in its capacity as special administrator? Absolutely. Is U.S. Bank, because you either with a fiduciary claim, you either have a category that's accepted, a trustee is a fiduciary, a special administrator is a fiduciary, a personal representative is a fiduciary, an attorney is a fiduciary. A shareholder would be a category, but the district court found as a matter of law that U.S. Bank is not a shareholder.
Did U.S. Bank file an answer, serve and file an answer?
We moved to dismiss. Yeah, we filed an answer, and then we moved to dismiss on the pleadings.
And does your answer respond to the pleadings about does your answer contain any information about whether U.S. Bank is a shareholder?
Yeah, we denied in our pleadings that U.S. Bank is a shareholder. U.S. Bank, the shareholder in this instance.
Did you explain the reasons why?
As a matter of law, the estate holds the asset, the 90% shares. So who's the shareholder right now? The estate is. And U.S. Bank, as the trustee at this point, previously as a special administrator, was acting as a legal representative of the estate. The factual assertions in the complaint that we responded to and denied are that U.S. Bank ever acted as a shareholder. They did not. In everything that counsel pointed to, it's crystal clear that what U.S. Bank was doing was acting in its capacity as either special administrator or trustee. U.S. Bank was never a shareholder. If you think about the danger of going in that direction, every trustee or personal representative who takes on the administration of an estate is suddenly also going to be a shareholder and is going to inherit, you know, Mr. Hall talked about hats. Well, we have the trustee hat, we have the special administrator hat. Where'd the magic shareholder hat come from? Like, trustees and special administrators do not sign up to be shareholders when they do this. They sign up to be fiduciaries with regard to an estate. And it's a really important difference. We have to make sure that people are being treated in the right capacity, are acting in the right capacity, and are being sued in the right capacity.
So I was thinking that the shares were owned by the trust, but are they now presently in the probate estate simply because it's in administration?
They began in the probate estate. U.S. Bank started its role as special administrator, and they were in the probate estate until approximately fall of 2019, I believe, and then they were placed into the trust, entitled in the trust. So now the shares are in trust, the shares that remain.
Isn't the pleading requirements of Rule 8 it's a relatively simple, low bar, right? A short, plain statement of the facts, and then on a Rule 12 motion, we simply ask, isn't it true that we ask whether any evidence, you know, after discovery and investigation, whether any evidence could be introduced that would prove those facts?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor, that's accurate.
So, I mean, if we don't know right now, don't we Well, we give the plaintiff the benefit of all possibilities that are, I'm using layperson's language, but.
So there is nothing in the pleadings factually that shows U.S. Bank acting as a shareholder. And I encourage you to look at the citations in the brief and anything that was provided by counsel with the briefing. In each instance, U.S. Bank is clearly acting in its capacity as special administrator or trustee, not as a shareholder. And what they get the benefit of the doubt for facts, you do not get the benefit of the doubt, and the district court got it right, for legal conclusions. The district court did not hold a higher standard, and they were very clear with what the standard was. The court cited motions to dismiss and motions for judgment on the pleadings where no facts consistent with the pleading would support the relief requested. Courts are not bound to accept as true any legal conclusions stated in the complaint. What the Demskys are trying to get the benefit of is saying fiduciary without any facts to support it, saying shareholder without any facts to support it, and there aren't any. That's the problem. Certainly with shareholder, where we have a very clear definition in the statute, but equally in terms of fiduciary as a shareholder, there simply are no facts where U.S. Bank is acting in any capacity other than trustee or special administrator.
But as trustee, I mean, can't we envision the possibility that if U.S. Bank is the trustee, that then U.S. Bank holds shares as trustee?
No, I mean, that's the concern that I'm trying to highlight is if you have a situation where, you know, a trust is a capsule that holds things safe for people. And in an administration, it's holding it safe for people pending the distribution to the beneficiaries. The trustee never owns those. They have badges of ownership under the trust code that allows them to take certain actions and have authority to do things in order to administer the trust. But U.S. Bank doesn't own these shares.
I thought well-accepted law that the trustee has a legal ownership, but not beneficial ownership. Legal title, if there is such a thing, the certificates might be in the name of the trustee, and but they're held in trust or for the benefit of others. It's not an unqualified right, but it's simply the legal ownership and then an obligation. But it seems like that in itself, that basically describes the ownership of shares.
As trustee, I don't have the trust code with me, but the trust code does give necessary badges of ownership, I think is the phrase that we use or we look at.
And the definition of shareholder includes,
beneficial, I know what you're going for. A beneficial owner will include a trustee.
Well, the shareholder is defined as a person registered on the books or records of a corporation, as the owner of shares.
And there's no evidence that U.S. Bank is registered on the books and records.
It's not the time for evidence. It's just the time for allegations. Yeah. And the question is, might that possibly be true?
It's not. And there's no that we've had discovery has closed, and there's been no evidence secured on that front. U.S. Bank.
You should have brought a Rule 56 motion then, maybe. But
well, and I think that the burden is on them to come up with. I mean, it's not pled. It's not in the pleadings. There's no pleading that says that they're on the books and the records. And I think the reason is obvious. It's because it's not true. They can't. The pleading still fails. I mean, if that fact were out there and they could prove it, that's one thing. But as a preliminary matter, it's not in the pleadings. And the court, district court, was doing the analysis on the pleadings, as is the exercise that they do on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. I just have a few minutes left if there aren't other questions. I just want to make a few closing remarks. The Demskys aren't shareholders, and this is not a shareholder dispute. It's a trust and estate dispute between beneficiaries of John Demsky's estate and his appointed estate and trust fiduciaries. We're not running away from that. The legal capacity in which people and entities act and bring suit matters, And not honoring that will only create chaos and uncertainty for any person or entity acting as a fiduciary, as a trustee, or a personal representative. Is that person a shareholder with all that it entails because they've agreed to be trustee? There's no precedent for that, either under the common law as a fiduciary or under the law of 751. The Dembskys are free to continue their probate and trust petitions, and they are continuing. And the shareholder suit was properly dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rani. Mr. Hall, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. One of the things that Ms. Rani mentioned was that trustees don't sign up for these kinds of duties. And I thought that was an interesting formulation because trustees do sign up to serve as trustees. Special administrators do sign up. In this case, U.S. Bank petitioned the district court to appoint it as special administrator. Petitioned it precisely because there was a corporate entity here that no longer had its 90% owner, and someone needed to step in and act. And U.S. Bank put its hand up and said, me, me, me. The beneficiaries of the trust, the beneficiaries of the estate, they truly don't sign up. They receive whatever they receive from the person who is deciding to dispose of their estate. And the notion that a beneficial owner granted this incredibly powerful right under Section 2 of 751, the right to seek a buyout in an action commenced by a shareholder, could be trapped if they don't happen to have that shareholder title because their interest is held in an estate that is going through probate or that is held in a trust that is currently being administered, may even be administered for decades pursuant to the wishes of the testator by some other trustee. In the typical shareholder dispute that we see, there's a group of siblings. Two of the siblings get sideways with a third sibling, and something happens. They start engaging in conduct that violates the reasonable expectations of that third sibling. If that third sibling has passed away and put their interests into a trust or has their interests currently in an estate, then under U.S. Bank's formulation of this, Section 1, they can't, the beneficial owners of that estate or that trust can't bring an action under Section 751. This court has already considered multiple situations where someone other than the person registered on the books and records might need to come in and bring an action under 751. In the Warthan case, this court looked at a situation in which no shares had yet been issued, no bylaws had been formulated, no directors had been appointed. And the district court there had ruled there wasn't really a corporation because it hadn't gone far enough down the road of becoming a corporation. This court reversed. This court said that the corporation did exist and it permitted the individual constituents who had come together to combine to form that entity to bring an action for involuntary dissolution. In the Zinanco case, this court allowed an incorporator to come forward and bring an action for a buyout. And in the Lund case, Judge Bernardson allowed an individual who owned her shares, all of them in various different trusts, as a beneficial owner to come forward and bring an action under Section 302A, Section 751, to vindicate her rights and obtain a buyout when those in control of the corporation frustrated her reasonable expectations. That's exactly what the Dembski beneficiaries are asking to do here. In terms of the question of whether U.S. Bank is a shareholder, I would just direct the court to look at the complaint. Look at the allegations in the complaint, specifically in that range from about paragraph 31 to paragraph 37, where the Dembski beneficiaries plead in detail the actions that U.S. Bank was taking as a shareholder of RTI. It was calling shareholder meetings. It was appointing individuals to serve on the board of director as a shareholder. It was voting and operating the company as a shareholder. And requiring the Dembskys to prove that on the books and records, it also says shareholder, books and records that would be in the control, expected to be in control of the company, not the beneficiaries here at the time that you're bringing suit, is simply not the law in Minnesota, where notice pleading, as opposed to technical requirements, governs how a case must be pleaded in the first instance. In the Walsh versus U.S. Bank case, the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at the meaning of serve, and I would commend that to the court's decision. Look at the Walsh case, because there the court said, serve has some factual meanings as well, and if you plead that someone has not served you, you don't need to plead in great detail all of the possible ways that service could be effective. You just say they weren't served. In a shareholder case, you just plead that they were a shareholder, and that is all you need to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.